Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, proud supporter of live music and driven to think big about beer since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Think big about beer.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and today we're dedicating the show to the Chicago Blues. Muddy Waters brought the blues from Mississippi to Chicago in the 40s, and ever since it has been an epicenter of that sound around the world. A little later, we're also going to revisit an interview we did with Buddy Guy, the iconic blues singer and guitarist. But first, the legacy of Alligator Records. Alligator Records is a Chicago blues label that's been around for almost 50 years. And while not necessarily a household name, Alligator Records has captured some of the most potent blues artists Chicago has offered since 1970, and has always championed a very raw and unvarnished sound, not unlike punk rock in a way. In 1970, 23-year-old Bruce Iglauer came to Chicago to work for the jazz and blues label Delmark Records, but quickly decided to stake out on his own. At a time when the blues was waning in popularity and prominence, Iglauer recognized that there was still an audience for blues among young rock fans who are interested in expanding their musical tastes. So this young white guy assembles a roster of some of the most iconic artists of the genre, and we're talking about people like Albert Collins and Coco Taylor, and got people excited about the music again. In his recent book, Bitten by the Blues, The Alligator Record Story, Bruce Iglauer, along with co-writer Patrick A. Roberts, tells the story of the evolution of Alligator, its landmark artists, and its importance in music history. Bruce, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thanks. I've been listening for years.
1971, Chicago. Blues scene is historic already. Chess Records, VJ. You enter the scene as a label head. What was the scene like at that point? What was your impetus for forming this blues label at that point?
The blues scene in Chicago was all on the south side and the west side, which means for non-Chicagoans, in black neighborhoods. It was black musicians performing for black audiences, mostly in neighborhood clubs, in bars. There were, on a weekend, 40 or 50 places where you could go on the south side or the west side and hear great blues. I could sit 20 feet from Howlin' Wolf or Muddy Waters and just be overwhelmed by this music, and yet so little of it was getting recorded.
Still, even after the heyday of Chess, I mean, the electric blues revival happens in the mid-50s through the early 60s, but by this point, nobody cared, 70?
Well, there were very few recording entities in Chicago or anywhere recording blues. Mm-hmm. You know, blues had been a popular music on black radio and amongst black listeners, but by the time I got here in 1970, it was an old form of music. You know, younger black people were listening to soul and various kinds of R&B and vocal groups and, you know, even the beginnings of hip-hop. Older black people still liked blues, but they weren't getting their music played on the radio.
What drew you, young white kid, to this music?
I first heard blues live in 1966. I heard a guy named Mississippi Fred McDowell from Como, Mississippi, with a steel slide on his finger playing at a folk festival. And the music just seemed so direct and so honest and so unvarnished. It was like he reached out across the rows of seats and just slapped me and said, wake up, this is for you.
You got to move. You got to move. You got to move, child. You got to move. But when it all gets ready.
After that, I just immersed myself in blues. It's music that comes from a reality. It's created between the listener and the performer. It's not music that you sit in your bedroom and work out with your synthesizer track. It's got to have an emotional effect on the audience. And for me, it's a healing effect. It makes me feel better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people miss that, the cathartic power of the blues.
I like to think of it as you're like the wet sponge and the blues is just wringing you out and squeezing all that bad stuff out of you.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Afterwards, the squeeze can hurt, but afterwards you feel great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of crazy, though, to start a label for an art form that, as you said, wasn't like all over the charts and a big moneymaker. I mean, there had been some blues crossover hits, a B.B. King, you know, The Thrill Is Gone, let's say. But it was rare for people to make great gobs of Rolling Stones-like money putting out blues records. So why did you jump in and do that?
It was all about love of the music. In 1970, I went to a club on the South Side called Florence's Lounge that had music only on Sunday afternoons. And I heard a magical band called Hound Dog Taylor and the House Rockers. Three guys, two guitars, two electric guitars, very loud, very distorted, and a drum set, no bass.
Yeah.
Playing the rawest blues that I had ever heard and the most danceable blues that I had ever heard. I can't dance at all. I could dance to Hound Dog Taylor. So I fell in love with the band. I went back to my boss at Delmark Records, Bob Kester, great hero of American music, and I said, you've got to come hear this band. They're wonderful. They have telepathy. They make you so happy. This is the happiest blues band in Chicago. Well, he had seen Hound Dog sitting in, and sitting in Hound Dog was kind of a disaster because other musicians couldn't follow him. So I couldn't lure him down to Florence's Lounge, and I thought, this band has got to get recorded. I've tried to convince my boss and my mentor and my father figure to record them. It's not going to happen. I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah.
So I started a label to record my favorite band, and 48 years later, I have a label to record my favorite bands.
Yeah. So Give Me My Wig, one of the first records, the first record you put out by Hound Dog Taylor.
Give Me Back My Wig is one of the tracks on the album that was just called Hound Dog Taylor and the House Rockers. And it was kind of his signature song, and it was the one that got played on that moment of wonderful radio, progressive rock, freeform radio, in the late 60s and early 70s. That was the hit, quote-unquote, from that first Hound Dog Taylor record.
What does Hound Dog say to you when you approach him and say, I'd like to put out a record? Does he think like you got two heads?
He had seen me at about 100 gigs.
There's a sucker.
Okay. You stood out because you were the white guy in the audience. Right?
And well, very often I was the white guy in the audience, or one of one or two. Although I got to say, I was treated very well by all the other people in the audience who realized they had come down to hear the music, and I wasn't a cop. And he had recorded, Hound Dog had recorded two 45s many years before. That was his entire recorded history. Nobody was approaching him about recording. And he knew there was some kind of a younger white audience, college-age audience out there for blues because Muddy Waters was playing for them. And when I said, I stood on the steps of Pepper's Lounge and I said, Hound Dog, I'd like to make an album with you. And without saying anything about what's the money or what kind of royalty rate, he said, I'm with you, baby. I'm with you.
Yeah, cool.
So this man is in his 50s at this point. This artist had been around for a number of years, but it was remarkable, as you said. You listen to that record, and it just jumps out at you. And I love the interplay between Hound Dog and the second guitarist, Brewer Phillips, right? Incredible. The telepathy we're talking about seemed to be the key to that band.
And the drummer was equal player in the band. They had played together for years. The music, you know, Hound Dog had honed his music playing for tips on Maxwell Street in the market and playing down south before he moved to Chicago, like so many alligator artists. So they knew exactly how to play with each other. I couldn't afford multi-track recording. We recorded that record directly to two-track. We mixed it as we went. What it sounded like was going to be exactly what it sounded like when the record was manufactured. Everything was performed live in the studio with the same raggedy amps and cheap guitars that those guys used in their clubs, and the amps turned up all the way for maximum distortion because that's the way they played. Yeah. I said, sound like you do at Florence's. Mm-hmm. And that was their job, and they knew it. And they just played each song a couple times, and we picked the best takes, and that was the record.
What was interesting about your label at that point was I think blues was sort of trending in the opposite direction in many ways, because you're starting, you know, B.B. King was recording with strings, and there was a little more orchestration going on. And then your records come out, and they do sound like they were, you know, a step away from being in that inside that club. You wanted to get that raw feeling in those recordings.
Absolutely, and I still try for that. I still like records that sound like you're 20 feet from the band and you're in a place that holds 100 people and there's a hard brick wall right behind the band and another wall on the other side bouncing with the sound around. And I try to make records that just sound clear and so you can hear everything that's going on, including every bit of distortion, if that's what the artist plays with. To me, the studio should be not very much noticed in the recording. You know, I love things like Sgt. Pepper, where they use the studio brilliantly, but that's not what I do, and that's not what Alligator does. Mm. The music is central, and the music should be as close to the way it's performed live, condensed, as possible. Mm-hmm.
So 300 records and half a century of history, Bruce. It's a complicated story to tell. Your book, Bitten by the Blues, does it really well. But what we thought we would do is take you through some key tracks. And you wanted to talk next about Coco Taylor. You know, I teach a class at Columbia for 300 freshmen. It's an introduction to Chicago via music. We do the blues, of course. And they are bored, right? They, you know, the blues. And then I play them. You know, Wang Dang Doodle. And then they're like, wow! Okay, suddenly they understand. Are we gonna pitch a Wang Dang Doodle all night long? All night long. All night long. All night long. All night long. Are we gonna pitch a Wang Dang Doodle all night long? What was Coco Taylor like when you worked with her?
Well, I met Coco in about 1972. She had that hit, Wang Dang Doodle, on Chess Records, which was a hit on black radio. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a crossover record at all. But by 1972, Chess Records had been sold. Leonard Chess was dead. Coco didn't have a band. She was just sitting in, and she was working days cleaning people's houses.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, she came up from down south with a third grade education. She either sang or she worked, and she always worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was not a lazy person. I heard her, and she had such power. You know, this raw, gravelly sound. It just came from so deep inside her. And then as I got to know her, I discovered that underneath that, there was a kind of a shy, soft-spoken person, very direct, very, in the best sense of the word, country, you know, not varnished at all, not trying to be slick. As I got to know her and heard her sing other things, I discovered there was also a layer of subtlety in what she could do. And it wasn't just this roaring voice all the time.
You have someone new, but I'm still in love with you. That's why I'm
she could always, always, always deliver on stage. And I thought, if I can capture that essence in the studio. Coco's first album for Alligator was done in 75 and called I Got What It Takes. And it kind of bombed. It didn't go anywhere. Mm. The blues audience liked guitar players and harmonica players and guys. And Coco was a singer. She didn't play an instrument. And this was hard for the rock and roll audience that I was reaching to relate to.
Yeah! I got what it takes. Yeah, I got it. I got what it takes.
But in 1978, we recorded her second album for Alligator called The Earthshaker. And for that album, she wrote a song that was to be an anthem for blues-loving women and blues women performers, which was an answer song to I'm a Man and Mannish Boy. Yeah. I'm a Man by Bo Diddley and Mannish Boy by Muddy Waters, called, obviously, I'm a Woman.
Mm-hmm.
I had suggested this idea to her, and she called me up and said, come down to my house. She lived on the south side. She had a bungalow with her husband and her daughter, and she sang this song for me, and I thought, this is exactly what I wanted. This is a song by a strong woman, by a tough woman, by a confident woman, by somebody who's not a pushover, not a Cupid doll in front of the band.
Yeah.
And it did. It worked. It became an anthem for her, and then other women started performing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very proud of that song because it gave her a level of confidence in herself as a songwriter and because it's become an iconic song.
When I was a little girl, only 12 years old, I couldn't do nothing to save my doggone soul. My mama told me the day I was grown, she said, sing the blues, child, sing it from now on.
That album is considered a classic by many people now, and it is sort of an emancipatory record from a female perspective. It's a distinctly female perspective. You can have my husband, you know, that song, you know. I'm a woman. These are strong, potent songs of a female expressing her individuality. One of your other big signings, and I think to your credit, Bruce, not only developing new stuff, but taking artists who had either been forgotten or who had started and their careers somehow stalled. A great example of that is Albert Collins, an artist that you signed, and he had a renaissance when he came to Alligator.
Every day, baby, when the sun go down, I get with my friends and I begin to clown. I don't care what the people are thinking. I ain't drunk. I'm just drinking.
And you did a record with him, kind of an all-star record in the mid-80s, right?
Right. Albert became the biggest artist on Alligator for a long time, and he wasn't a Chicago artist. He was born in Texas and lived at that time in California. In the mid-1980s, I put Albert together in the studio, and I should give credit to my co-producer, Dick Sherman, who had actually brought Albert to the label in the 70s. Albert wanted to record with his great friend, Johnny Clyde Copeland, the Texas Twister, a wonderful blues man with a huge gravelly voice, and his protege from the Pacific Northwest, the then almost unknown Robert Cray. When Albert's career wasn't going well in the 70s, he would go to different cities to perform by himself, and he would hire a local band to be his backing band. And when he went to the Pacific Northwest, it was the young Robert Cray band.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert and Albert just bonded. It was a father and son relationship. We put these guys together in the studio, and in 3.5 days, we recorded a record that has stood as a classic Chicago and world blues record called Showdown, where they took each other on in a very friendly competition. All we had to do was get these three guys together with a great rhythm section in the studio and get out of the way.
And though the moon is full, I feel my dog coming down. I said the moon is full, I feel my dog coming down. You see, I met this little girl. You see, all my friends call me crazy, but they just don't know how I feel inside. I said, all my friends call me crazy, they just don't know how I feel inside.
When we return, more with Bruce Iglauer, Alligator Records founder and author of Bitten by the Blues. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.